Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis and uprocks.com. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. Today, we're going to be talking about Siamese Dream. The album's 25th anniversary is upon us, and Smashing Pumpkins is back together, or at least most of them are back together. They're on tour right now. The tour is, I guess, doing pretty well from an artistic standpoint. It sounds like the shows have been really good. The band is playing for like 3 hours. They're playing all oldies, pretty much, like a career-spanning set. And they're also doing covers. They're covering Stairway to Heaven for some reason. I don't know why, but the reviews that I've read of the tour seem to be good. At the same time, you know, and this has been well-reported, the ticket sales are kind of soft. You know, there's reports of half-empty arenas or like two-thirds full arenas. And it just makes me think about the legacy of this band that was huge in the 90s, one of the big bands of the alt-rock era. And certainly Siamese Dream is one of the bellwether albums of that time. But you also wonder, what is the window that a band has to come back? Sometimes you feel like these comebacks are perfectly timed. Like you think of the Pixies in the early 2000s when they came back and there was this real sort of feeling of anticipation and appreciation from people that felt they were never going to get to see this band play live again. And it was a great response. So great that the Pixies are still together and playing reunion shows, you know, 15 years some later. But there really does seem to be a time where you need to come back in that window. And if you don't, people start to lose interest. And I wonder to what degree that has happened with the Smashing Pumpkins. You know, you could also blame the drama that's gone on around this band, and certainly the launch of this tour didn't go well, you know, with Darcy, the band's bass player, talking about how she was involved at some point, and then she wasn't involved, and then she was posting screenshots of texts from Billy Corgan that made him look terrible, as if Billy Corgan has ever looked good in the media, but this made him look even worse than he usually does. And it seemed like that had an impact on the tour. But you also wonder, does touring with other musicians under the banner of the Smashing Pumpkins, if that hurt the brand, you know, that sort of thing? It's just a very curious thing. And I wanted to talk about that process with this band, as well as Siamese Dream and the importance of that record, with a friend of the podcast, and that is Ian Cohen, a man who has been on this show many times, and a man who, by his own estimation, has written, I think, 50 or 60,000 words about Smashing Pumpkins in his time. Like, if you go on Pitchfork and you read about Smashing Pumpkins, chances are Ian wrote that piece. This is one of the big bands of his life. So I was very curious to talk to him about Siamese Dream, you know, why that's a great record, and also have a larger discussion about, you know, the status of this band, this band's legacy. Is this a band that that people still care about, or that has any contemporary relevance at all? Or did they miss their window to come back? And are they sort of playing out the string on this arena tour that seems to have a mixed reaction, to put it lightly? So we had a great talk about it. It's always great having Ian on. So why don't we get down to it? Here's me and Ian Cohen talking about Siamese Dream and the state of the Smashing Pumpkins. So, Ian, I was talking with Derek, our producer, and I was saying we're going to talk to you today, and he's like, oh, he's like the Alec Baldwin of the podcast.
I'd like to think of myself more as like the Paul Simon or the Steve Martin or...
Right.
I'm just trying to think of like the Chevy, like the Five Timers Club on SNL.
Yeah, like John Goodman. Yeah, because when Derek said that, I was like, oh, do you mean because he's like increasingly less funny each time he comes on? Is that the point of that?
That's not where I was going.
I think you meant it as a compliment.
I'll take it. As long as it's not like Billy Baldwin or like, you know, some of the lesser Baldwins.
Right, right. Well, Stephen is the like religious one, I think. Or he's like the conservative one. The Stephen Baldwin.
I think that might be Billy.
I think Stephen is too, though. Maybe they, well, because Steven was, all I know about him is that he's in The Usual Suspects and that he's like really conservative now. But maybe Billy is too. I don't know. And then there's Daniel Baldwin too. He's the other one. He's like the bigger one, I think.
Well, we're gonna have to have a separate Celebration Rock just for the sake of Baldwin discussion.
We'll do the we'll map out the Baldwin family tree.
Absolutely.
So, Smashing Pumpkins. Speaking of a Billy, yeah, I was talking with Derek recently about this tour that they're on right now, and Derek and I are actually going to go see Smashing Pumpkins on this tour next month when they come. I think they're playing in St. Paul. And I'm pretty excited about it. I mean, I've been reading about the shows. They're playing for like 3 hours. They're playing like covers for some reason. I mean, I don't know why, because they're already playing like about 27, 28 songs, but they're also playing like Stairway to Heaven and all this other stuff. So the tour looks pretty cool. But then at the same time, and this has already been reported a lot of places, but it seems like no one is showing up, or like very few people are showing up. I got an email from a reader yesterday telling me like he saw them in Austin, and he said it was a great show, but they were doing that thing like where they put tarp over like whole sections of seats because, you know, they haven't sold it, or curtains or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, is this just merely a function of Billy Corgan having alienated everyone, or did they wait too long to get together? Are people sort of like over this band at this point?
It's an interesting thought. I mean, and I'm lucky because I'm seeing them in L.A., which I do believe the sales have been strong for that one. Like, apparently, like, Chicago, L.A., like, you know, obviously Chicago, there's still some goodwill in that city towards him. But, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, we've seen, like, Guns N' Roses, like, kind of fuck up their legacy, but still, I mean, well, mind you, Guns N' Roses is a far bigger deal. But, you know, you've seen bands who have... you know, like a band like Guns N' Roses still have a very successful arena tour, like bringing to the degree they can the original lineup. I think with Billy's sake, I don't think they were helped by the drama that surrounded the reunification of it. Billy Corgan has done himself no favors whatsoever at all in terms of like kind of creating an aura or mythos around like the reunification of Smashing Pumpkins. And yeah, I think it's hard to tell whether it could have been timed better, or but it was definitely not handled the way it could. I mean, like if Billy Corgan had somehow never, you know, been on Alex Jones or, you know, done any of that stuff, would there still be the same result? I don't know. I just think what maybe might have been a better scenario would be to, you know, have like to do the announce maybe at like Riot Fest, for example, or Lollapalooza, where like it's like, oh my God, they're coming together for like one show, like the way Jawbreaker did. I mean, I know it's, you know, Jawbreaker is a much smaller band, but nonetheless, like kind of anchor it with like the first show is this big festival appearance and then kind of do the tour off that with some goodwill. But I mean, I don't know. It's been handled pretty much as poorly as possible. And, you know, the best case is that the people who go to the shows actually say, you know what, it was actually really good and I had a great time, and they maybe seemed like they were having fun, and they can do, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like what the mode they're in right now. It's like, we got to be professionals here and just plow through. I mean, Derek and I were talking about how we were trying to figure out like the shows that they play before coming to St. Paul. I was hoping that they would play Chicago right before St. Paul, because I know those will be big shows. Because I just wonder, like, because, you know, we're not seeing them for another month. And I just wonder, like, by then, is Billy Corgan going to be, you know, melting down at that point after staring at all these, like, curtained off seats, you know? So I was thinking, like, if he plays Chicago before here, maybe he'll be uplifted and it'll be a good show. But we looked it up and he's playing, like, a bunch of smaller markets or secondary markets. They're playing Indianapolis before here and, like, Sioux City,
yeah,
Dakota. Like, where else, Derek?
There was, the tour itinerary was like wild. Like after here is Omaha and then Sioux City, and then they're out to the West Coast. But there's definitely some off the beaten path markets along the way.
Yeah, it's like a serious tour.
There's an Idaho show later on.
Yeah,
Nampa, Idaho.
They're like playing. They're hitting like all 50 states or something at this point. I mean, Derek, when we were talking about this the other day, I thought he made a pretty good point about how, Would this have been different if they had done this 5 years ago? You know, because I do think that, you know, even without all of the drama that happened, which I think you're right, that obviously I think hurt this tour, but I think there's also a window that you have for these reunions, like where your stock is at it's at its peak and people are really excited to see you. Mm-hmm. Like I think of like the ultimate example of that being the Pixies.
Yeah.
Like when they first got back together, there was so much excitement for that, and I think there was just this feeling that, well, you know, there were so many people that loved the Pixies and thought they would never get to see them live, and then they came out, and there was so much excitement for it, and then, I mean, they're still doing that 15 years later, of course.
With Weezer.
Yeah, exactly. Weezer, the same thing.
Or, like, conversely, the Stone Roses, like, right. Kind of waited too long.
I was at that festival, by the way, the Coachella where the Stone Roses played.
Yeah, and then no one was there.
And they were, like, a good 10 years too late, yeah. At least 15 years maybe, to mm-hmm. do that. I mean, do you think there's anything for that? Because I just wonder, because, you know, there's some bands from the 90s that continue to have big audiences that people still talk about. I mean, has the sort of relevance of Smashing Pumpkins just in general, even without all of the BS around them, do you think that's faded at all?
I would say with Smashing Pumpkins, it's... I think 3 years ago, or sorry, 5 years ago, they were doing like the reissues of, I remember because like I wrote like 50, I've written probably like 50, 60,000 words about the Smashing Pumpkins in my lifetime, way more than any other band. And, you know, I was doing, like they would do the steady reissues of everything from Gish to Adore. This was up to 2014, and I think at that point, there was some goodwill churning. I mean, like, you know, that you could start to see bands who may have been, like, influenced by them in a way. You know, Billy Corgan hadn't completely, there was no Disneyland thing. There was no Alex Jones thing. There was no, there was none of that stuff. And, you know, maybe at that point, they could have come back in a way, like, with the original lineup. I mean, if they brought back Darcy, I mean, that would have been a big deal. I think so. But I do think the timing of this, like every other administrative aspect, was just off in a way that did them no favors. Because, I mean, when we talk about, like, right now, you know, when I think about, like, Smashing Pumpkins, the way people talk about them, like, they're really, in terms of, like, sound and, like, I don't know, like their ethos or whatever, it really kind of clashes with the forces of alternative rock, which are relevant in the current day. I mean, you know, like people, like bands in the current day, like you know, like Nirvana is always going to be Nirvana, but like also because like Kurt Cobain stood for certain things. Whereas, you know, you get a guy like Billy Corgan, who everything has always been about him, very kind of needy, very... Yeah, it doesn't quite have the same effect in the current state of things that it would have like 4 years ago.
Right. Yeah. If you're looking for, you know, a poster boy for like white male privilege, you will not find a better target or an easier target than Billy Corgan.
I don't know,
in a lot of ways.
Privilege, but like resentment. I mean, I think you described him in like your book as like being very Nixonian, and
right.
You know, I mean, it makes perfect sense. Bill, I don't know how much of it is trolling, and I don't know how much of it is like due to the fact that like Billy Corgan has lived a very unusual life, and at a certain point, I mean, you know, at a certain point, you can only relate to other people who are like rock stars. But he just kind of signifies this. You know, kind of white suburban resentment, which, you know, granted, it troubles me to like, you know, in the sense that like everything has like this moral component, it's like the kind of you are what you eat sort of thing. The same with like listening, where it's like, you know, Smashing Pumpkins, like Weezer, like these are all bands that were like viewed as, you know, or are currently viewed as, you know, more, for lack of a better term, problematic in their views, and it's, you know, it's not something that most people will say. Most people might say, like, okay, Siamese Dream, like, Melancholy, these are phenomenal records, like, really important documents of their time, but they're not something that perhaps translates to 2018. It's not something that we want to revisit.
Well, although with Billy Corgan, I feel like a lot of that has to do with things he's done outside of the band.
Absolutely.
The interviews that he's done, especially lately, like you mentioned, going on Alex Jones. He's seems to have taken this sort of alt-right turn somewhat, at least sort of under the guise of being a libertarian, you know, that whole thing. Although, you know, with Billy Corgan, I tend to think of him in the same way that I think about Kanye, and that I don't really feel like he's a political person. I feel like he is a person who is extremely self-absorbed, who takes umbrage at how he has been perceived, certainly in the indie rock world, you know, and how he's been sort of slammed by, you know, I guess cooler musicians, if you want to put it that way, or musicians that have more indie cred, and, you know, that obviously goes all the way back to Pavement, but there's a lot, you know, but Smashing Pumpkins in their day was a target of that whole crowd. And I think he takes those sort of personal offenses and he extrapolates them into this worldview, which is very about being against elites and being persecuted by elites, which tends to line up with this sort of alt-right point of view. But again, you know, I mean, Billy Corgan, as a person who is in the wrestling business here, I tend to just look at him as a heel more than anything else, and I don't really take that stuff that seriously. But yeah, it does make me think, though. I mean, I tweeted this once. It was a joke, but I said that I love Siamese Dream so much that I would help Billy Corgan move a dead body. You know? Like, I felt like I owed that to him because he made this record. But I mean, is there anything that Billy Corgan could say or do that would make you not love this record anymore? Like, what would it take for you? Because there's certain things, like, you know, I can give up Space Boy and DQSA because he went on Alex Jones. But, like, Cherub Rock, you know, he's going to have to, I don't know what he's going to have to do. He's going to have to be, like, a guest host for Alex Jones. Or
shoot,
he's going to have to
shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue.
Maybe. He's going to have to become, like, Trump's new Supreme Court nominee or something. I don't know what it would take. I mean, on any level, has that lessened your appreciation for what he's done, or are you able to separate that from your feelings about his music?
You know, when I think back to, like, the way Billy Corgan, like, operated, even at, like, the height of his powers, I mean, like, the Pavement, you know, issue is the one that most people focus on, because, like, he has not let that grudge go. But he was also, like, attacked by Steve Albini, Kim Gordon, like Courtney Love, I believe. Like, I mean, we're talking about, like, the pillars of, like, alt rock cool, like, indie rock coolness of the 90s, all of whom seem to have a real big problem with Billy Corgan. I think he really thrived off that, because, I mean, you listen to Cherub Rock and it's like, it is a salvo, like, it's just kind of like a pro-selling out sort of thing, you know, just kind of going in the face of, like, this idea of, like, indie rock elitism, and, you know, that it's, I mean, that was 1993 when, you know, we had, like, no idea, like, how this stuff might play out in the current day. In a way, I mean, I think maybe I'm, like, better than most at, or, you know, more well, at least in my private life, better at kind of, like, separating my feelings about, like, the artist's public life from their music. I mean, to listen to Siamese Dream today, I don't really hear Alex Jones. I don't hear, you know, Billy Corgan at Disneyland. And, you know, and maybe to a degree I get kind of annoyed at the way he's being treated or whatever. But, like, because, you know, people just got to, like, make fun of, you know, it's got, like, I mean, if Twitter was around 1993, this guy wouldn't last a minute. But, you know, I listen to Siamese Dream and it's like, it almost makes me appreciate it more. In the sense of, like, wow. Like, when you listen to, like, the records that he makes now where it sounds like Smashing Pumpkins, but the spirit's not there, it's like, I mean, it's just incredible that we actually got records like that out of this guy. You know, that all of his perhaps, like, misguided ambitions or all of his resentments or all these things that, you know, are just kind of bad vibes and in the current day seen as things that should not be in music. You know, it's like he used that to, you know, make just some incredible art that really resonates just on a pure emotional level. And, you know, the thing about, like, that record and other ones from, like, artists who I find to be, you know, in their personal life, like, objectionable, I mean, it's I think there's an underrated or at least maybe lesser acknowledged part of art where you can, like, process your feelings kind of in a private space through Siamese Dream. You know, it's like, you know, when I have, like, those feelings, which are very real and very human, I can, you know, listen to Siamese Dream, embody that in kind of my, you know, and, you know, process it and, you know, go about my day. And I appreciate how it's there for me in that sense. I mean, then, you know, that's on a sheer emotional level. Otherwise, I mean, the fact that, like, you know, Cherub Rock, like, sometimes I can just listen for the drums or the guitar. I mean, it's right. Incredible work of musicianship between, you know, him and Jimmy Chamberlain, like, possibly, like, my favorite guitarist and my favorite drummer of all time. It's in the same way that, like, when people are like, well, you know, has Mark Kozelek, like, has he ruined, like, all the Red House Painters album and Benji with, like, the dumb shit he does? It's like, in a way, they almost make it, like, more, I don't know, like, more transcendent, the fact that, like, he was able to do that before it all went wrong, you know?
Well, and, you know, the thing with Billy Corgan is that it's not like he was ever, like, this great, stable, nice guy.
No, not at all.
That's always been part of the package. That's why, you know, when people talk about the drama about this reunion tour, in a way, I mean, I'm surprised that that wasn't, like, better publicity for them, because it's like Smashing Pumpkins, that's what they do. Like, there was always dissension. There was never this belief that these were all pals and that everything was smooth sailing. I mean, that's part of the package. And I think with Billy Corgan, if you buy in to him, you are buying into his petulance as much as his brilliance. You kind of feel like that's part of the package with him. But, you know, and I would also say, too, that, you know, the thing with Corgan is that it's one thing to be maybe a jerk or to have opinions that are not to my liking. It's another thing if you're actually, like, assaulting people or you're breaking the law or you're, you know, like, Bill Cosby is one thing. Billy Corgan going on Alex Jones, as like, horribly embarrassing as that is, it's like, it's just him talking, you know? It's him having horrible opinions. I feel like having horrible opinions shouldn't necessarily be a capital offense, you know? And I think that applies to Kanye as well. Like, you can look at him and you can excoriate him for wearing a Make America Great Again hat and criticize his public statements, but I don't know if bad opinions alone should totally sort of X out your feelings about music. Of course, this is a personal thing. If you personally can't enjoy someone anymore because you know too much about how they feel, I totally understand that. But, like, for me, I feel like words themselves are probably not enough. You know, there's always examples that you could bring up. There are certain things that you could say that it would be enough probably for me to excommunicate it. But for me, I don't know. Like, in my, I have this mailbag column that I write for UpRocks. And, like, one of the questions I answered once was someone asked me, like, is it morally wrong to buy tickets to the Smashing Pumpkins tour? Like, someone actually asked me that. And I said,
they probably believe it.
Right. And I understand if, again, you can't enjoy his music anymore just because you think he's such a loudmouth, I totally understand that. But, again, to turn it into a moral issue about whether you're going to buy a ticket or not just seems kind of extreme to me.
Yeah, I mean, and once again, this is you and me, like, discussing, like, a personal preference rather than, like, a way people should go about, like, being, I don't know, a conscientious consumer of music or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, like, but also, like, the comparison between Kanye and Billy doesn't really quite hold up because, like, you know, Kanye was making, you know, depending on your tolerance for Life of Pablo, like, great music as of 2016, you know?
Right.
Whereas, I mean, look, I love Machina as much as the next guy. Or not as much. I love it way more than the next guy. The next guy probably fucking hates it. But, you know, and, you know, I still have some time for Swan. But for a long time, they were just making music that was completely embarrassing and all of which, like, I think that did far more damage to the Smashing Pumpkins brand than, you know, anything he could have said or did. Because, I mean, you know, if Oceana was good, like if that other record that they put out in 2014 with Tommy Lee on drums was any good, maybe that wouldn't be an issue. But there's not a lot of reason to really root for Billy the same way that you would root for Kanye, because he can pull out, like, you know, an album like Daytona, you know, like, even amidst all those issues or whatever. And moreover, it's like, I think that sort of attitude, that sort of villainy, does not play quite as well, perhaps, in rock music, where, I don't know, it's just, I just don't think that there really is, or maybe that people aren't allowing, like, the room for villainy, you know?
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's sort of seen as, like, everyone has to be, like, kind of, like, morally upstanding or whatever, and it's like, the thing is, like, I mean, with Billy Corgan, it's like, yeah, you're right, he's not done anything, like, overtly harmful to people besides, like, you know, being an asshole. Shit. I mean, if I have to really think about, like, whether or not, like, being an asshole would disqualify, whether or not I can listen to music. I mean, shit, that cuts a lot of stuff out. And, like, you know, some people might say, oh, well, that's the way it should be. But here's the thing, man. I think with that kind of stuff, like, especially in the current day, like, there is that, like, moral component. It's like, we should listen to music by good people because that will make us better people and that will support good people or whatever. But, like, I mean, I don't know if, like, most of the people I know who are, like, legitimate, like, great people, like, the people I work with, they are, like, at best bystanders to pop culture, and they love, you know, Smashing Pumpkins and so forth, and, like, John Mayer and, like, all these people who, like, have done these things outside the scope of the mainstream that have made them bad people or whatever. And it's like, but most of the people I know who, like, listen almost exclusively to, you know, like, Fugazi or, like, Slater Kenny, I mean, like, are they that much? Like, you know, they're probably on, like, you know, those are the people I know who are on the internet just arguing about music all day. So, I mean, is it really input output sort of thing?
And what about James Iha? He seems like a nice guy.
He seems, I mean, God, can you imagine what he's been through?
he's played
in the band with Billy Corgan and Maynard, man. Can you imagine?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so let's not throw him out, too. He's playing on this record, and Jimmy Chamberlain, I don't know if he's a nice guy or not. You know, again, like, you have to do background checks on everyone in the band to see if they've ever been rude to a waitress or, you know, didn't hold a door open for an old lady or something. I mean, if you really want to talk about, you know, because again, I think it's like one thing to say this person committed crimes or this person has been accused of assault or rape or, you know, any kind of heinous act. I mean, that's obviously something that you draw a line in the sand that's unacceptable. But to go all the way to whether someone's nice or not, or they have, you know, opinions that you agree with, I just think that's a little extreme.
Well,
ultimately,
I mean, also,
it's
also
impossible,
like,
to enforce. But, you know, again, I think that's a personal choice. People have all kinds of reasons for the music that they like, and I would never try to argue against someone saying, no, you should like Smashing Pumpkins because, you know, I think it's a great record. If you think he's a jerk and you don't want to listen to it, I totally understand.
We argue about music on the internet where this stuff, it's like, you got to do something to fill the time. And I just think that most people really just have no consideration whatsoever of, like, most people have no idea about, like, Billy Corgan's personal life to the same degree that people probably don't know about, like, John Mayer's Playboy interview.
We're going to get back to the conversation here in a minute, but I just want to tell you about my new book. It's called Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. It is out now at your favorite bookseller. It's a book about the rise and fall of the classic rock era. Artists of the 60s and 70s. I'm talking about Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Bruce Springsteen, Bob Dylan, Neil Young. All these people that you've heard on classic rock radio forever. They were codified into this generation of bands that was sort of frozen in ember for the longest time. And now we're experiencing them starting to retire or in some cases even pass away. And I wrote a book about that. I wrote about my own sort of firsthand experience with that, as well as looking at the sort of historic and critical arc of this music. If you like this podcast, I think you're going to like the book. It's basically like listening to me talk, except you don't have to hear me yap. You just see my words on the page. It's funny. It's sad. It's exciting. It's depressing in parts, But I think it's a good read. So again, the book is called Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. It is available now wherever you buy books. Okay, enough shilling. Let's get back to our conversation.
I just wonder, honestly, like this thing I was thinking about this morning is like if I often find there's like a generation gap of sorts when discussing bands like Smashing Pumpkins. When we voted for the, at Pitchfork, when we voted for like the 90s singles list, I think that came out in like 2009 or something along those lines. Especially with like most alt-rock in general, there was a huge difference between my feelings and opinions towards that stuff and those of people who are like 5 to 10 years older. And like, it's, yeah, I mean, like, even back then, it's like, would it be okay to like Smashing Pumpkins because like Billy Corgan is like totally against indie rock and like an unapologetic quote sellout. And I think about like the way I look at bands now, like certain considerations are, at a certain age, or I don't know, like these things like come up. And that's why people like, I think Nirvana is seen as, such this divine thing right now, because they stood for a lot of good things that were completely went over my head at 12 and 13. But like everything that Smashing Pumpkins stood for, like, that I related to that on a very, very visceral level.
Right. And you just brought up, I think, a really good point, because there's a generation of bands, I think, from the 90s that is revered by a fairly narrow, maybe, group of people. And I think Smashing Pumpkins is in there. I think Weezer is in there. Mm-hmm. I think maybe you could make a case for Pearl Jam being in there, where, like, people that grew up that were maybe, like, between the ages of, say, like, 12 and 18 when those bands hit, they love those bands. But people who were, like, 5 years older and, like, came up in the 80s and listened to, like, Husker Du and the Replacements and all that stuff, they looked down on those bands. And then the people who came up a little bit after that, who maybe listened to like Fall Out Boy or they were nu metal fans or something, they're not always into those bands either. So they don't have, some of those bands I feel like don't have like the legacy reputations that, like the Smiths have or the Cure has, or like those sort of great, bedrock, alt-rock bands. There's still like some of those 90s bands that they don't translate if you're a little bit older or you're a little bit younger. I mean, does that make sense to you?
I think it does. I mean, when you go to a music festival, and like, I think Nirvana, like as far as popularity, I mean, they were, you could correct me if I'm wrong, I think they were like pretty much dwarfed by Pearl Jam.
Oh, totally.
In real time, and maybe even so by like the Smashing Pumpkins or what have you.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Nonetheless, I mean, just, and you want to talk about like a moral issue. It's like, Kurt Cobain's like suicide. Like, I mean, has that like, is it okay to like listen to them because like it, his legend was like kind of, fomented by that. But it's like there. It just does seem like there's this all, like, I mean, I think people will discover Smashing Pumpkins or whatever because like classic rock radio still exists. Same with like the Red Hot Chili Peppers. It's weird. I think the Chili Peppers, the Chili Peppers have made like relatively, decent music over the past several years to a higher degree than Smashing Pumpkins. But I think there is like the aspect of who was the captive audience at the time,
Right.
And we don't necessarily have that now. Like when I was in middle school, high school, like that was what, like 93 to 98. So those bands, like, those were the bands I knew of, and I didn't really have much of a choice.
Right.
But like, the ones from earlier, like the late 80s, 93 or whatever, it's, I think age does play like a huge role. And, with like Pearl Jam and so forth, I mean, like, well, Pearl Jam kind of stepped to the side, and Weezer just kind of kept going and became a cult act. And I don't think that was ever the plan for Smashing Pumpkins, though. And I think that's why this tends to have a much, there's like much more negative light on this tour compared to what some of their peers have done. Because like Weezer is just like straight up cult act, like a huge cult act, but still like they there's a lot of fan outreach. Same with Pearl Jam. Like Billy Corgan, one of the Smashing Pumpkins, be the biggest band in the world, like always. And yeah, I mean, I think even when Soundgarden came back in 2014 or something along those lines, you know, it was a big deal, but like not that big a deal.
Right. And even Soundgarden, you know, they were, they
Speaking
started
of
in the 80s.
Rivals.
yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel like Soundgarden had like a little bit more cred with like the people, again, who were like maybe indie rock people or alt rock people in the 80s, you know, like that came up because Soundgarden kind of started in the 80s. And I feel like Soundgarden was like one of the grunge bands that was acceptable for like older people to like.
Oh, but they were on SST and Sub Pop too.
Right.
So.
Whereas, like, if you were a kid in the 90s, there would always be, like, the older people, like, at the record store or something, who would, like, make fun of Smashing Pumpkins or, you know, like, that's, or they would call, like, Weezer, like, fake alternative rock, you mm-hmm. know, stuff like that, because, you know, that was sort of, like, kids' music to them. And I totally remember that divide. Were you going to say something, Derek?
I was going to say, those Soundgarden reunion shows did sort of undersell.
Yeah. I saw them at, like, the Eagles Ballroom, I think, in Milwaukee, which, you know, I think is like a couple thousand. Yeah. They weren't playing arenas or anything.
Yeah. I think that it seems like to me there's a tier of bands, like Soundgarden, I think the Pumpkins are in that tier, Stone Temple Pilots, that were, at the time, as popular as any of the bands going. And then I think just sort of their legacy, they're like sort of the REM of like the U2 REM debate, where it's just like it stopped somewhere.
Yeah, like they don't get passed down. And there's like, and it's just intriguing to me to see the bands that get passed down, that like you will talk to someone who's 18 and they respect them. And like, again, like you, like the Smiths have that. Mm-hmm. Or
well,
like the Pixies
never
have
ever
it.
Huge, you know?
Right. Or like, yeah, and you said like Nirvana, like you see kids wearing Nirvana shirts.
Yeah. I mean, that's like classic rock as far as right. like most, like you go to a festival, it's like, it was to the same degree you saw people wear Pink Floyd t-shirts.
Yeah.
Like when I was in high school.
You get their shirts at Target now. Right.
Right.
You can still do that. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Siamese Dream here. We haven't gone too much in depth with this record yet. You know, and I was listening to it this morning and, the first seven songs on this record, I'm trying to think of like another record that starts as strong as this, and like it really does get down to like the biggest records of all time. Like you have to, it is in that rarefied air. I feel like after that, there's some good songs after that. Mayonnaise, in particular, is an all-time great Smashing Pumpkins song.
I was about to say Mayonnaise is the ninth song, man.
But we have Geek USA in there, which I think is the first song that is a step down from the first seven. Mayonnaise is back up to that standard. And then the last, say, four songs are all good, but they're not up to the standard of, like, look, we got Cherub Rock, Quiet, Today, Hummer, Rocket, Disarm, Soma. I mean, that's just like a murderer's row of Smashing Pumpkins songs. Like that, like, when I see them live, I just want them to play those songs in order. And I could probably leave after that because that is Billy Corgan's like pinnacle, as far as I'm concerned, just like one after another, just knocking it out of the park. I mean, do you think Geek USA is up to that standard? I feel like that's like the first song where I'm like, this is good, but you were like on a seven song transcendent run before that. And then Mayonnaise, like if you put Mayonnaise like eighth, you know, you could have ended the record right there.
Yes,
it would have been
celebration rock style, eight songs.
Exactly.
Yeah. All bangers.
I know, like, I mean, you love this record too, obviously.
Yeah,
I mean,
apparently way more than you.
so you don't think there's any let up at all?
Here's the deal. I think that, Geek USA, I remember reading, okay, like, this is how deep I go with, like, Siamese Dream, where, like, I have a, like, almost photographic memory of, like, Billy Corgan's, his column in Guitar World magazine, where he would show you how to play certain songs, and he would also do shit like make fun of Steve Lukather from Toto. Like, it was just like the most Billy Corgan thing imaginable, where it was like on one level like super generous and so, but like also extremely petty. But you mentioned that Geek USA, Butch Vig called that the best drum performance he'd ever heard in his life. You know, Butch Vig saying that. And I think Geek USA, I mean, it doesn't, I think it kind of, it's a bit of a break from the rest of the record. It sort of brings in side B. I mean, like, Geek USA, I think it's just a kind of evidence of the uncoolness, I mean, title aside, of Billy Corgan. You know, it's just a lot, like pretty much all drum solos and guitar solos, and it doesn't quite feel as tight as the rest of the record. But I mean, like, and he also talked about like Space Boy. Like he said in that column, it's like, I know this isn't a song that people really, you know, request when I'm playing live, and you know, maybe it's not the level of the stuff, but you know, it's a song that's like super meaningful to me because it's about his like brother, who I believe suffers from autism. And I mean, you look at like classic, at most classic albums, you know, there is that one or two songs that, you know, does this one really belong? And, you know, Smashing Pumpkins have never been the kind of band to me to make like a tight 10 song, like, you know, like Celebration Rock, Born to Run,
right,
Back in Black style thing. Like with Billy, it's just all about like the sprawl, the ambition, to see just how the possibility that like he's going to fall completely flat on his face. And you know, a song like Silver Fuck is pretty evident of that as well. Like, and I like the interludes. I like Sweet Sweet. I think that, you know, side B of this record, you know, is to a degree like weaker, however you want to put it.
Oh, it's definitely weaker. I mean, and again, I'm not saying you should take those songs off. I'm just saying the first seven are like tens out of 10. Like every song is like Cherub Rock. Great opener, obviously. You have Quiet, which is a great song as
great
well.
Great non-single second track.
You have Today, of course, which is perfect. You have Hummer, which is like, I guess you could maybe call that an underrated Smashing Pumpkins song. I don't know if that's underrated.
So, because, I mean, it's like right, it's the first six songs are like four singles, you know?
Right. And then, of course, Rocket, amazing.
I think that one's underrated.
That might, I mean, that is definitely one of my favorites. You have Disarm, used on The Shield with Vic Matt. I think it was at the end of, like, the season of one of the Shield's seasons. Doing a shout-out to The Shield there. And then you have Soma, which is, like, that could be my favorite Smashing Pumpkins song, too. There's, like, three or four candidates for, like, the best Smashing Pumpkins song ever in that first, like, opening run.
Yeah.
I mean, that side A is, like, unbelievable. It is, I mean, I'm just saying, like,
but I mean, like, what?
Like,
but
side
then
B
we
is weaker,
talk,
but it's only because side A, I think, is one of the great side A's. I think certainly of like '90s music.
Well, I mean, we could have the same discussion about like Nevermind. It's like, does, you know, does On a Plane or Something in the Way really have the same, you know, juice as like what comes before it?
Yes.
But I
mean, Nevermind is like, I don't think there's a weak track on Nevermind.
Nah, well. I think in a lot of ways that, you know, Nevermind is, like, tighter or whatever. But, like, with Siamese Dream, like, yeah, I won't argue that side B is weaker. You know, that's a given.
It's only because side A is, again, one of the great sides ever.
But
so,
I
you
think
know.
That, I mean, when you look, but then again, you look at the next record, like, Melancholy. It's like, would this be better as a single disc? Probably. Are there some songs on there that, like, even I, as, like, someone who would call it, like, my favorite record ever made back in, like, 1995 or 6? Would cut out. Yeah, I don't need to listen to We Only Come Out at Night. I don't need to listen to, you know, Beautiful or whatever. I don't need the James songs. But, you know, Smashing Pumpkins speak to that kind of sloppy, not sloppy maybe, but like that kind of unstable sort of genius that Billy Corgan has that just kind of need to give everything, even if it comes at the cost of like, doing what would be the more artistically mindful thing, you know?
So if you had to pick one, Siamese Dream versus Melancholy, which one do you pick?
what, based on what? I mean...
You gotta pick one. You got to pick one that you can... You can't hear the other record ever again. You get one.
I mean, it would make more sense to say Melancholy because there are simply more songs on it. But I would say that, you know... I'd have to go with like Siamese Dream only because like the weakest song on like Siamese Dream is like not even in the same stratosphere as like the weakest song on like Melancholy, and I think the best songs on Siamese Dream are still like better maybe or ones that maybe I love more than you know Melancholy. I mean it's just like. I don't want to choose with Smashing Pumpkins, you know? It's like I have Siamese Dream for certain moods, Melancholy for others, Adore for others, and, you know, maybe Gish and or Pisces is scary once in a while when I need to, like, break it up and, like, go back to something that isn't quite as overexposed.
See, I'm going to be much shorter in my answer. I love Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness. I think it's a great record. I'm glad that it's a double record because I love double albums, but this is an easy choice. It's Siamese Dream. Siamese Dream is a great, great album. I was thinking on the drive over here about which 90s albums are better than Siamese Dream, and I came up with Nevermind, like The Chronic, OK Computer, and that was it.
I would say that The Chronic is one I listen to. I'm like, God damn, why don't I listen to just this for the rest of my life, you know? It's like, fuck, man. I mean, I would put this above Nevermind because, you know, as far as I just, you know, I'm a Corgan over Cobain type person. That's, you know, just the kind of way I operate. I would say that, yeah, I was thinking, like, is what my favorites in the 90s are. And, yeah, like, OK Computer, I don't know if I'd put that above. I know it's more important. And I know it's more innovative, but, like, which one am I going to listen to most often? Like, probably Siamese Dream because, like, the emotional component of it is so clear and crystallized. And, I mean, the same thing with, like, Jimmy Eat World's Clarity. I know that's, like, way outside the scope of, like, these things, but it's, like, I get the same stuff out of it now that I did when I first heard it.
Yeah.
And OK Computer has been, like, just saddled with so much importance of, you know, its influence and, like, how it spoke to the technological, like, uncertainty. I mean, when I first heard, you know, OK Computer, I was, like, in Israel, like, on a teen tour getting high. And, of course, that shit sounded deep. But, you know, with Siamese Dream, it's, like, it's that music that just has the emotional, like, just speaks to, like, these kind of childlike emotions and these sort of, I guess, like, kind of feel bad music, I think it was sort of called, you know, where it's like the same things that you may have felt about your place in the world at 13. When they pop up at age 38, you can go to Siamese Dream, have your moment, process it, and then go about your day, like, you know, feeling clean, you know?
Yeah. OK Computer and Siamese Dream. That's a great death match, man. I would probably take OK Computer for a lot of the same reasons you just said. I know there's a lot projected onto that record, but I still think ultimately that's just a really emotional, big-time, epic rock record. And that was one of those records that I heard that after I heard it, I just, like, wanted to hear 10 other albums that sounded just like it.
Oh, yeah. You know? I mean, it was completely life-changing to the degree that, like, Siamese Dream is not.
Well, but, man, they're both examples of just titanic albums.
Oh, yeah.
What would you take, Derek? Deathmatch.
Oh, well, you know, I'm OK Computer over everything.
Yeah.
For me, Siamese Dream's great. I'm curious, because you've written a lot about your love of Oasis, if either one of the first two Oasis records.
Oh, yeah.
Is in that conversation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, yeah. But that's almost like a different thing. It's almost like saying, because, like, I love, my favorite album of all time is Alien Lanes by Guided by Voices. But in a way, I think, you know, even the Oasis records, which were, well, certainly the second one, anyway, was really popular here in America. Siamese Dream and OK Computer, to me, are different because I just think of them as being, like, these sort of cultural landmark albums in a different kind of way, in the same way that Nevermind and The Chronic are, you know, like, where you just feel like, certainly in my world, those albums were, like communal albums. They were communally experienced and, like, everyone kind of, like, knew what they were, and it just gives them a different level of feeling than a record that you kind of love yourself, but maybe it was just you listening to it. Like my friends weren't listening to Alien Lanes. You know, as much as I love that album, it doesn't have the hugeness of sound or scope or cultural impact that a record like Siamese Dream did, where you can kind of talk to anyone that was alive at that time, and that was, like, if you knew they were into rock, you could talk about Mayonnaise. You could bring up, you know, which wasn't even a hit. You could be like,
yeah, it wasn't even a single.
Yeah, like, isn't Mayonnaise? That's a jam, right? Yeah. You know,
what about the Black Album?
Oh man. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. That's another.
Oh, Metallica. I'm like, what?
Yeah, not Jay-Z.
Yeah, kind of
That's another one where, yeah, it was just. Yeah, that's fruit in that conversation, too. I mean, I don't think it's as good as these other albums, because I think about half of it is, like, not that great. Like, Don't Tread on Me and some of those album tracks, but like the singles certainly are like still so huge.
And that's a game-changing sort of impactful record.
Yeah, and that's like the biggest rock record of the last 20 years, or last 30 years, I guess. So you can't deny that. But yeah, I mean, Siamese Dream, though, I mean, again, I feel like I'm not being very analytical with this record because I just went through like the side A and I was like, this is great, this is great, this is great, but it's true. I mean, I think I would pick maybe Soma as my favorite track, maybe Rocket. I don't know. It's hard. It's hard. Again, that side A, I'd put up against any album, really. I mean, certainly of its era.
And here's the thing, like when I think about Siamese Dream, like my emotional connection to it, the guitar tablature book, that's an important part of it. Because, like, you know, it's a great album to play on guitar, even if you're just like in your room or whatever.
But yeah, I mean, it's just hard. It's hard to be analytical of this record for me in a way, because it's like analyzing your yearbook photos or something.
Yeah, fuck being analytical, man. I mean, like Oasis, like how are you supposed to analyze like why that, you know, like why that's, you know, why that means something? And when I think about that, it also makes me kind of, I don't know, feel not hopeless isn't the right word, but like when you look at like the way we discuss music now, it's like none of this is going to matter, because like in 13 or 15, however many years, like the stuff that was like super duper popular is going to be, you know, replacing whatever the heck we were talking about now. And and you know, I think people kind of see it. It's like, yeah, might as well listen to the kids.
Right, exactly. Or yeah, whatever they're liking right now is going to be what really mattered, you know, in this moment. Like we probably don't know. It's probably just some SoundCloud rapper, I'm guessing.
Nah, it's probably like, you know, I think we're going to look at like the critical rehabilitation of like Post Malone, Imagine Dragons, and The Neighborhood. Like whatever's on K-Rock right now, I should really just be spending all of my time listening to K-Rock if I really want to be on, you know, consider myself like a conscientious listener of like alternative rock.
Right. Well, you know, I look forward to doing a podcast in 10 years on Imagine Dragons. We can talk about how Thunder was the defining song of the 2010s.
And you know what? You'll have to get someone besides myself, because I have like only the slight, every time I listen to alt rock radio, like, you know, in the van right now, where it's like, okay, is this Imagine Dragons or does this just sound like Imagine Dragons, you know?
Right.
Get to know 21 Pilots would be my advice.
Right.
Yeah. Like 21 Pilots. I mean, like there's going to be a, as long as Celebration Rock is alive, you're going to refill, you're going to like have some kid who's like 13 or 15 now going to tell you about like how Blurry Face changed his life.
Right, I can't wait. I'm already sucking up to 21 Pilots. I want to, you know, I want them to be nice to me in 10 years. So, you know, you're the best 21 Pilots. I love you. Ian, always a pleasure to have you on. I appreciate it. And thanks for being our Alec Baldwin.
Awesome, dude. You know what? I feel more validated in my career than I've ever been in my entire life. So,
right, man.
All right.
We'll take care. We'll talk to you later.
You too, man. Later.
All right, that was me and Ian getting into it, talking about the Smashing Pumpkins, talking about Siamese Dream. I am going to be seeing Smashing Pumpkins on their upcoming tour. I am still looking forward to it. I've actually never seen Smashing Pumpkins before. I saw Zwan in like 2003 in a college gymnasium in Ashwaubenon, Wisconsin. That's as close as I've ever gotten to Billy Corgan. So I'm excited to see this tour. I think it'll be a good time. These are all songs that I love. It seems like the band is playing well. I don't see why it wouldn't be a good time. My only fear, again, as I said in the episode, is that Billy Corgan will be so alienated by the response that he might chuck that show. So hopefully that won't happen. But at any rate, I want to thank you all for listening to this episode. I got to give a shout out to Derek Madden, the man who makes it happen, our producer. Thank you, Derek. Also got to give a shout out to Josh Copperman, the man who wrote our theme song. Josh, thank you so much for that. And of course, thank you to all of our Celebration Rock listeners. Thank you for being there. Thank you for making this show possible. Thank you for your support. You guys are the best. Thank you so much for that. Guys, we will be back again next week with more Celebration Rock. We'll talk to you then.
On the Westwood One Podcast Network.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
see the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL Fan Festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.